Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots.
How about family, Bart? How are you fixing that department?
Well, my folks live in Brooklyn with my uncle.
Mine have passed on. Yeah, it's just the three of us now. What's that expression? Me, myself, and I.
Sure. That's tough. But in a sense, we're all alone in the world, aren't we, Charlie? I'm often surrounded by family and friends, but...
You're no stranger to loneliness, then.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Pod Shots. I'm your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are discussing the 1991 film Barton Fink. The film was written and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen and stars John Turturro and John Goodman. Here to discuss the film with me is returning guest, Mr. Ben Teed.
Hello!
Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. And Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial membership. Just go over to audibletrial.com/plainlabelpodcast and choose from over 180,000 audio programs, download a free title, and start listening. It's just that easy. Go over to audibletrial.com/plainlabelpodcast and get started today. So, Ben, let's do a little drink roll call. What are you, I heard a little rumor that you're not drinking water.
Nope.
What is it that you're drinking?
The very last bottle of Yuengling Original Black and Tan from the post-celebration of Appleseed Comic Con. In the final chapter of the saga of Zach Kruse. Yes,
the Fort Wayne farewell or whatever.
Yeah. I went over to, because past the Ohio line, they don't serve Yuengling anywhere in Indiana. And also, I think it was a Sunday, so they weren't, so it's like a dry state, so they just don't sell it.
So I know Minnesota's like Ohio. That too, I guess.
Yeah. And I went over the border and got some and came back, and now I'm just finishing it. I poured it into my Shrek 2 glass. I'm already.
There it is. I like that. I'm going with an interesting combo here. So I'm having a red wine. It is a Robert Mondavi, or I think that's how you say it, Robert Mondavi. His wine, and it is a red Zinfandel.
Ooh.
And it's fine. Like, it's nothing really to write home about, but it's all right. But the only clean glass that I have that's a wine glass, because, of course, I'm too fancy to put it in, like, a cup, right? I would never dare.
Do a solo cup.
Yeah. And so I'm having out of this, it's a wine glass, but it's one of those that doesn't have a stem on it. So it's just like the glass part, you know?
Oh, I love those. I have some of those.
And so we have some of them as well, and we got them... I think we got them for ourselves after we got engaged, which by the time this releases has been a while ago. And this one does say Mrs. on it, and it does have a little high heel etched into it. So this is the only one that we have clean.
Appropriate
story.
I think that's good.
That's what I'm sticking with. So that's what I'm having. Robert Mondavi, Red Zin out of a Mrs. Wine glass with a high heel on it. So
I support this.
So there you go. So let's go ahead and kick off our discussion of our first Coen Brothers movie that we've done on this show.
It really is our first, isn't it?
Well, it's the first I've done, period, and it's definitely our first.
Nice.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And it is the 1991 film Barton Fink.
For the first time in the history of the Cannes Film Festival, one film has swept all the major awards. Barton Fink.
Welcome to Los Angeles, Mr. Fink.
Excuse me?
Howdy, neighbor.
Are you a writer, Mr. Fink?
Actually, I'm writing for the pictures now.
Oh, it's an exciting time, then.
Is that him? Is that Barton Fink?
Say whatever the
hell you want. The writer is king here at Capitol Pictures. We're only interested in one thing. Can you tell a story, Bond? Can you make us laugh? Can you make us cry? Can you make us want to break out? Enjoy a song. Is that more than one thing? Okay.
Devil on the canvas, 12 apple, take one.
Just having trouble getting started.
Wallace Beery, wrestling picture. What do you need, a roadmap?
We all need understanding, Barton.
Oh, you'll lick this picture business, believe me. You got a head on your shoulders. And what is it they say? Where there's a head, there's hope.
I'm sitting in the audience. The lights go down. Capitol logo comes up. Come on.
Hank?
LAPD.
Got some questions we want to ask you.
Charlie, I'm in trouble. Something horrible's happened.
A male Caucasian, about 30 years old. Ever seen Munt with anyone fits that description?
But, you know, with the head still on.
Well, Barton, you might say I saw peace of mind.
Right now, the contents of your head are the property of Capitol Pictures.
But Charlie, why me?
Because you don't listen!
I'm a writer.
A new film by Joel and Ethan Coen.
That's good. I mean, it's awesome because we've done Kubrick, we've done Lynch. We're doing like all my favorite directors.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I feel like we're doing all the movies I'd be like intimidated to talk about. I always say that when I come on the show. I always feel like, gosh, I don't feel like I'm smart enough to talk about these movies, but we'll see what I can do.
We'll see how it goes. We'll see. Okay, so the IMDb plot synopsis of the film is as follows. In 1941, New York intellectual playwright Barton Fink comes to Hollywood to write a Wallace Beery wrestling picture. Staying in the eerie Hotel Earl, Barton develops severe writer's block. His neighbor, jovial insurance salesman Charlie Meadows, tries to help, but Barton continues to struggle as a bizarre sequence of events distracts him even further from his task. And I think that that's fairly well done, because if someone were to ask me, what is Barton Fink about? I'd be like,
yeah.
Wow, it's about a writer that can't write. Oh, great.
There's so many themes, yeah.
I mean, if I tell them it's about a writer that can't write, I mean, they would look at me blankly like, that sounds like the most boring movie I've ever seen, you know? It is definitely much more than that.
Yeah.
So we were briefly discussing in a little snippet that I may put at the very, very end of this show about the selections that we have and, you know, how we had done some Kubrick and we had done some David Lynch, and now we are on to the Coen brothers, and we decided on Barton Fink. And Ben, remind me, why did we decide on Barton Fink? Because it was one.
They were showing. So in my town of Fort Wayne, they have like a mini theater where they're showing all these like independent films and stuff like that, but one of the events that they were having was a Coen Brothers event where they were showing Barton Fink, and this was my first time seeing it.
Uh-huh. So you got to see it on the big screen first time, right?
Yeah, and since I didn't have anyone to go, my wife was working that night, you know, I asked some friends in the area last minute or something like that, you know, I wasn't able to go with anybody, so I did what I always love to do on my own, and that's sit in, like, the first or, like, second row. I'm, like, really weird about that. I like going in and sitting there and stuff like that, like getting the whole picture like huge in front of me. So it was a really good experience for me to see it like as big as possible.
Wow. So it's like really claustrophobic for you almost.
Yeah.
I mean, close, right?
Yeah. What it does is, I mean, that theater's not like, it doesn't have it's like maybe 100-seater or something like that. And the frame or the screen isn't like IMAX size.
Sure.
But it's probably about standard size or whatever. And, if you sit in like the second row or something like that, it's just, it fills your vision and stuff like that. And I feel like what I do is because no one sits that close, and people should maybe try this sometime. I don't know if anyone's, brave enough to waste a ticket if they're not happy with it, but like move closer to the screen, you end up like kind of segregating yourself from the audience because everyone's like flipping their phones or if they're rude or crunching on popcorn or something like that. When I'm like so close to the screen and away from people, I'm like absorbed in that story. I lost myself for 2 hours just simply because I was closer. I can't tell you how many times I've gone with friends or been with my wife and I'm sitting in a movie theater and we're about midway through the entire theater, middle section up, middle section across, like we're like dead center in there. And that's probably best for like the sound or whatnot. But to be honest, like, I don't know. I see everybody else and I don't know. It's this separation that I think that kind of helped me really get into this movie and respond to it. So
that's interesting.
Just a side note.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a good one to do that on because it's not like a action blockbuster to where you need to have the sort of, like a little bit of a distance maybe to appreciate all of the sound design or all the special effects. But yeah. with it being so close and having it pull you in, I would imagine that it makes some of the things more tangible, like you can feel the heat a little more.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to having it be a small screen.
You're actually describing it really well, like that ability to kind of like be transported into that world. I mean, whatever it is, not even necessarily Barton Fink, but I think you're right. This might be a good film to do that on because, you know, even when I watched it a second time with my wife, in our living room, because I ended up leaving the theater and immediately like ordering the Blu-ray and I got it sent to me and we finally sat down and watched it earlier this week. And like, there were moments where I was flipping onto my phone or she was flipping on her phone or something like that. There was these moments where we understood what was going on. And, but like, I guess, you know, our TV is a little smaller, you know, and we sit so far away from the television. So it's like, it's possible that that it's just how you're seeing the film could affect it as well.
Oh, absolutely.
The experience. So,
oh, I think that's absolutely right. I know that earlier this summer, it was a thing where, Anel and I wanted to go see Mad Max.
Oh yeah.
And so it was a thing where I had heard from several people go to the biggest screen and sit as close as you can and all of this. Go to the biggest, loudest screen. And so we went and had a blast, and I think that was part of it, was that we were just completely sucked into the visuals and the sound and all of that as much as the actual story and what was happening. With this movie, I had quite a different experience in terms of watching it than you did. This is one of the very few Coen Brothers films that I had not seen before.
Oh.
And so when we had sort of stumbled upon Barton Fink, you had said like, oh, this is going to be playing near me in Fort Wayne. I was like, well, that's as good of a reason as I've ever heard for me to finally watch this.
Yeah.
And so I watched it and we had a house guest at our place, which is a little tiny little apartment. And so they were in the living room and I was in our bedroom. And so I'm watching it on our TV in our bedroom, which is, you know, like probably like a 32-inch. And I'm sitting on the bed watching it like a good, you know, 10, 15 feet away. And so it's a real small screen. And I heard it. And I heard it fine, right? Like, and I saw everything, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it was a much different sort of mindset, I'm sure, than what you had.
Yeah, I bet. Like, I feel like I have had both experiences now because, I mean, I was about 15 feet away. I would say about 15 feet away, too, when we watched it that second time. And I didn't respond to it as much, I think, simply because of that fact. I still, like, you know, kept, you know, during all these really good parts, like, shifting my head a little bit to look over at my wife and see what she thought. And, like, wasn't that good? Like, kind of, you know, I don't know if she noticed me doing that. But yeah, yeah, that second time, although I still love the film and stuff like that, I don't think I responded to it as well, just simply because of the setting.
Yeah, and I think part of the thing is with a film like this, for me, it was a film that, I mean, I guess we haven't said yet, but I enjoyed the film as well. It was a movie where I watched it and kind of enjoyed it on like an intellectual basis, but it didn't have like a visceral, like gut level sort of reaction out of me. It wasn't like when we watched Eyes Wide Shut, which I think was our last discussion that we did.
Yes.
Where I watched that and was like, oh man, this is so weird. What does this all mean? Fidelio, you know, there's all this crazy shit going on and all of that sort of thing, to where I was really sucked into that. And this one I quite enjoyed, and I thought Turturro and John Goodman and everyone in, you know, cast did a very good job. And I walked away from it going, wow, that was good. That was a good movie. But I wasn't like, oh my God.
You know? It'll change your life.
Yeah, I wasn't like, oh dude, you gotta see this, you know. Which I don't think necessarily that they're going for. Like, I don't think that they're going for some sort of over-the-top reaction. I mean, there is a sequence that is definitely very memorable towards the end, where you're like, what the hell is actually happening right now? You know, with Mr. Goodman and his character reveal and his coming into the hallway of the hotel. That's quite the scene. That's the thing. You know, that's a sequence where I'm like, holy shit, what is happening right now?
Incredible.
That's really something. So, you watched it twice, so I'm going to go ahead and assume that you liked it.
Yes, very much. I even bought the Blu-ray immediately, like, in the parking lot, got on my phone, ordered the Blu-ray. Like, that's how much I was into it. Also, I'm trying to collect all as many Coen Brothers films as possible. I mean, all the ones I hear that were not as good or whatever, even those, just because, I mean, I'm such a huge fan of these directors. I think they're the greatest living directors right now. Mm-hmm. Like, for me, I mean, there's hardly a film that comes out that I watch by them that I enjoy, like, everything, you know, Wes Anderson puts out, or anything Quentin Tarantino puts out, or, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson. But when it comes to, or Jim Jarmusch, the list can go on. but when I sit down and watch a Coen Brothers film, I know I'm going to get a certain type of film, but there's also, because they have such a range in their writing and their filmmaking, I also am excited because I will usually come out genuinely surprised, not at the quality of the film, but what the content is in the film. Like, I had no idea what to expect in a movie like Inside Llewyn Davis. To go back a little further, No Country for Old Men. Yes. I hadn't read any Cormac McCarthy books yet, or have known anything about, you know, really the Coen brothers.
How was it that you were able to be friends with Zach if you hadn't read Cormac McCarthy? I thought that was a prerequisite.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I'm not even sure if he had read any of Cormac McCarthy's books yet.
Oh, really?
I saw No Country for Old Men in the theaters, and that might have been my first Coen Brothers film.
Hmm.
Back in, what was it, like 2007 or something like that? 2007. And I think I had just started hanging out with Zach a lot more, just because we were working at the shop.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even sure if he had read any of that yet. I think he started reading it a lot more when he became a student.
I see. So I figured he had a little questionnaire, and it was like, you must fill this out before we are to be friends.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Now he does.
Right. But when we... Oh, Zach. So when we, you know, when I think of the Coen brothers, I think that's the thing that I think of is unpredictability. I never know what sort of movie they're going to make. I think the same, to a less successful extent, of Danny Boyle, who has done 28 Days Later. And
that's a good analogy, I think.
The Beach and, you know, all of those kind of movies. Train Spotting, you know, and very different movies.
2016, Coen Brothers are making, I think I looked up on IMDb, they're writing and directing a film called Hail Caesar.
Yep, in post-production right now.
I have no idea what that is. I have no idea what it means. I'll be going to it, though. You best believe I will be in probably around that first day just to see it.
And so some of the things that I think is so odd about them is my introduction to them is, or was, Raising Arizona. And that was a movie that I watched with my mother several times. And it was a thing where it was on like USA, and it was on something either USA or Fox or something, and it was on it a lot. And I always remember the biker with the grenades and all of the grease that's in John Goodman's hair, or the lard or whatever it is. And my mom used to always say, comically, she would do the "I love him so much," the crying sequence that Holly Hunter does, and that I'm not going to try, but that's she would do that quite often, and so that would always be kind of like our little inside thing. And so I saw that movie, and I was like, God, that is fucking weird. Like, that's such a strange film. And it's just got this real sort of crazy, you never know what's going to happen kind of a feel to it. And I kind of forgot about them and didn't know who they were at the time, but I didn't, you know, I didn't see anything anyway that said, oh, from the makers of Raising Arizona, because I did not see at the time Miller's Crossing, which was their next film. And then they made this film, which is Barton Fink. And then they went on to make the Hudsucker Proxy, which I saw only a year or two ago. Fargo was kind of their big deal, obviously. And I saw that, but it was probably like 98 or so when I saw that, so a couple of years late. And then they made Big Lebowski and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And those were both big deals. And then we had kind of a lull where they made The Man Who Wasn't There and Intolerable Cruelty and The Lady Killers. And those kind of didn't do that great. And weren't really that well received in terms of the Coen brothers at that moment. And then they do a movie like No Country for Old Men, and then all of a sudden they're like the thing again, right?
Yeah.
And then they went on to do Burn After Reading, A Serious Man, True Grit, and Inside Llewellyn Davis. And then they have, like you had already mentioned, Hail Caesar, which comes out next year, which I don't know anything about either. And
they've written a Cold War movie. Forget what it's called.
Oh, right. With Tom Hanks
and is directed by Steven Spielberg, which everyone there sounds great. Looks like it's going to be a good time. I've seen the trailer.
Bridge of Spies.
Yeah. I'd just the names, the makers of this movie in general. I'll go see that.
How could that go wrong, right?
There's a special place in my heart for Spielberg, too. Like,
there you go.
Even recent Spielberg stuff, I'll go see it. I'm not above anything.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, too, is it's like Spielberg, it seems like he gets shit for making kind of popcorn movies sometimes.
Kingdom of the Crystal Skull? Popcorn movies,
not bad movies. But or like when he makes blockbusters that aren't, you know, real deep thinkers, it's like, well, not every movie he makes needs to be list, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Jaws is a great movie, but it's not a deep thinker. You know, it's not like you're sitting there and pondering the motivation of the shark. You know,
oh man, but what if they made a movie like that? Oh my God.
I'm sure there's something that tried to do that. A remake of Jaws where you get inside the mind of the shark. Coming 2 years, right after the Back to the Future reboot. So long way around getting to getting back to Barton Fink. It's a movie that I had not seen. It's a movie that I didn't really know was a Coen brother movie at the time, when I would see the kind of really interesting choice of the poster of John Turturro's face, just kind of looking dumbstruck.
I couldn't tell that was him.
Yeah.
Like, it's incredible.
It's like a funnier version of an Eraserhead poster is what it looks like.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't realize that, but yeah. Speaking of Eraserhead.
Yeah. Speaking
of David Lynch or whatever.
Right. So that's what that kind of looked like to me. And I was always like, oh, I don't know, this looks really weird just by the poster. It looks odd. It's by the Coen brothers. I'm sure it's going to be good, but it just looks strange. And sometimes I feel like I need to be in the right mindset to go along with the strange.
That, you know, that's a good point. You, when you're sitting down for a Coen brothers film, normally you're going to have to do a little bit of work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But not too much, I don't think.
No, it's
maybe a little less than some pretentious directors or directors that pretentious people love, I guess.
There we go. Like, like a Thomas Anderson, like you said.
Right. You're going to have to work a lot in that kind of film
directors
like that.
That always have to say something that you that don't just make like a movie just.
If Joel and Ethan are listening, I apologize for that comment.
I'm sure they're huge listeners. Okay, so getting into the actual movie, here's some of the things that I had written down that I thought were interesting. This was, for people that maybe didn't look up the IMDb trivia, which I actually did this time, this movie they started making while they were doing Miller's Crossing. And Miller's Crossing was the movie that came before this. They had kind of hit a dry spot in the writing of that, or in the filming of that. I don't recall which it was. But they were making that movie and kind of hit a point where things weren't really working for them and came up with the idea of this movie. And so they came up with the idea of Barton Fink. And Barton Fink at the beginning strikes me as a very art versus commerce, plays and Broadway versus Hollywood kind of simple compare and contrast is kind of what I was thinking. Because I didn't know what the movie was about. I just knew that it was John Turturro, who was a guy that was a writer that had writer's block. And that was kind of it.
I actually didn't know anything going into that theater either. I didn't know about John Turturro. I didn't actually know any of the players.
Oh, really?
All I knew was the title and the directors, and I was in there. I was ready to go. I was wanting to do all that. And so I didn't even know about time period, that it took place in the 40s in Hollywood. All the comparison. No, I haven't heard a single thing.
Wow, that's great. Though that's the best. Like, that is absolutely the best way to see a movie.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's damn near impossible.
Nowadays.
Yeah. Like, if you want to go see any movie, like, one of the movies that I use an example of is my current favorite movie of 2015, and it is Ex Machina.
Oh, I still need to see it.
And it's not the Brian K. Vaughan comic Turned to Life. So it's So Ex Machina, and it is Oscar Isaac, and I always think of him as the guy from, as one of the brothers from Harry Potter, but it's Mad-Eye Moody's kid is the redheaded guy, and he's also in.
Oh, okay.
But that's who he is. But anyway.
You got Oscar Isaac from another Coen Brothers film.
Yeah, Inside Llewellyn Davis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have yet to see that, but I knew that he was in it, and he's also he's going to be a big deal with the whole Star Wars thing.
He's going to be in a Star War.
He's in one of the Star Wars.
At least one that we know of.
Yeah. So I feel like people are going to know him real quick, right? People that are not like cinephiles, have you. So that movie I knew very, very little about going into it. I knew that it was an Alex Garland movie, and Alex Garland was the writer behind 28 Days Later. And also The Beach, which is infamous in terms of how poor that did with that Leonardo DiCaprio. His post-Titanic choice was The Beach, and it was a huge bomb. And not a great movie, but it was just kind of more a fault of what it came after than anything. That's kind of what I knew. I knew it was sci-fi, and I knew it was Alex Garland, and I knew it had Oscar Isaac. And that was it. And so this Barton Fink, I knew about the same sort of thing. I knew the directors, and I knew kind of what it was like. And so I thought I thought it was going to be kind of easy to figure. Like, I just kind of thought he was going to go to Hollywood and it would be a thing where, oh, it's not the sort of writing that he likes and he's going to strive against it. And then I kind of, about 15 minutes in, was like, well, it's a Coen Brothers, so it's not going to be that silly or easy. So that's silly of me to think that I have them pegged, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that one of the things that I thought was really interesting is I thought it was interesting that he's not just some nobody moving to Hollywood and trying to like pull himself up from his bootstraps and make something of himself, right?
He was already super famous.
Yeah, he's already famous and established, and he's a guy that doesn't really need to go to Hollywood.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking there? In terms of like what the Coen brothers are writing?
Oh, it's definitely a meta commentary. It's
yeah,
they didn't need Hollywood, Right.
They didn't need Hollywood. They didn't need. I mean, they're renowned anyways. But at the same time, like, the running joke I love at the beginning is you can see it, but you can't quite see it fully. That it's their commentary on their own success and famous, you know, and stuff like that. But you can also kind of the reason why I like that beginning so much is and the reason why I love the Coen brothers so much is I almost feel like that's their, I'm making complete assumptions here, but you almost feel like he says something like, I want to make a difference.
Because
the guy's like, you go to Hollywood and do what you do. And he goes, you do know what that is, right? Which is of course writing, but it's him saying, I want to make a difference. I want it to mean something to the common man and stuff like that. And his whole like tirade on like our theater and stuff like that later on, you almost kind of feel like they believe in it, but they also realize how silly and ridiculous it sounds.
Yeah,
and that's kind of the self-deprecating of themselves is so good. I wish there was a better word. I feel so in on the joke.
Oh, sure.
Because of the history you and I know of these two gentlemen working this long on these different projects. And yeah, everything isn't complete, you know, masterpieces, but most of them, Eric.
Yeah, most of them are. Yeah, sure.
Most of them are considered like.
It is odd because I would think that someone that would write those sorts of lines, basically saying like, I don't need Hollywood, Hollywood needs me. You know, that sort of attitude, not in an arrogant way, but like, look, I'm going to bring something to the common man. I'm going to show them, I'm going to make them feel, I'm going to, you know, that sort of idea is kind of what he's running with on Broadway. And so he's going to bring that to Hollywood, and the Coen brothers are going to bring that to Hollywood. I just think that that's really interesting that this is their fourth film and they're making that commentary. It's not like it's now, where they've had, you know, Oscar nominations and are famous for being who they are. But this is at the beginning of their career.
Actually, yeah, I thought about that as well. I'm not even sure if I have. I'm not sure. I know I don't have the context for that. I don't know what their mindset was like. I don't know what the zeitgeist for Coen Brothers films were back in 1991 when this was being released or anything like that, and they were saying this, or if this was just based on another character or based on another just real life person or something.
Sure. Knew. And you know, it says, you know, the IMDb trivia, which is of course never wrong. Like I said, it says that it was written during Miller's Crossing. So it was written before their third one was even finished. So all they had done so far was Blood Simple and Raising Arizona.
Mm.
And so it's just interesting. It does strike to me a little bit like they're trying their wares in Hollywood, and so they are like Barton Fink. You know, they are. He is representative of them, kind of a thing. And I also do really like with that sort same sort of thing is how when he goes to Hollywood, he's not really like completely dumbstruck and completely intimidated, really. Like he's a little put off by Jack Lipnick, played by Michael Lerner, who did get an Oscar nomination for this, the studio head. he's like a little like, what the hell is this guy about, you know? But he's not really shying away from the sort of the enormity of writing a picture at the time. Like he develops the writer's block, but at the beginning he's just kind of confident, and it's this sort of, I think the IMDb plot synopsis calls it a hellish truth of Hollywood.
He kind of just comes in and he's quite indifferent to the goals of Lipnick and the other general, these directors, these head of studio people. Like he's just kind of indifferent to their crusade of trying to just get butts in those seats, you know. Oh, just write this wrestling picture, you know. It's not that hard. It's just, it's a formula, whatever. But like,
he's got a dame; it writes itself.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's like, he's not really working. He's not even thinking about, gosh, like, I really just need my shot. You know, he's past that point that he's like working super hard and stuff like that. Cause like, if he fails at this, like, big whoop, you know, probably to him or something like that, but that's never spelled out. Like, he never, you know, that's just my interpretation that I've taken away from it. When he's sitting there in the theater, in the office of Lipnick, you know, and Joe's standing there, is his name Joe?
Lou,
yeah. They're both sitting there and stuff like that. He's just kind of like got this weird like look on his face, like, I don't understand you. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. And like, mm-hmm. in some ways and stuff. So yeah, I thought that was interesting. Cause I look at the way Fink deals with this, with these characters, these crazy, based on probably real people characters, as to how the Coens react in real life.
Sure, sure.
One of the things that these two people, these two directors, one influencing thing that they did was the night that they won. I don't remember what they won. I think it might have been best directing or something. It was for No Country for Old Men, the year that they won.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Whatever the Oscar was. And they both go up to the front and they just hold up the statue and go, thank you. Like, that's all. I mean, like, we don't really, it's not, they don't, you can tell that although they're thankful and yeah, we appreciate your stuff, we're not going to conform to your weird, twisted, like, rules.
They won for best director and for best adapted screenplay.
Okay. Oh, excellent.
And best picture. So it was one of those. So
I really think that was a good adapted screenplay because the book is strange. Anyways, what else? I was gonna say from what I've seen and hearing in interviews, hearing the two brothers speak and stuff like that, they have this kind of calm. I was gonna say aloofness, but it's not like they don't know what's going on. It's mm-hmm. not like that they're completely. Not have a handle on themselves. It's more just kind of like just a strange, unconcerned, but that's kind of sounds like
it's like a mix of not being overwhelmed by moments and being so self-assured. Like they're just so comfortable in their own skin. They seem like, you know, like nothing is overwhelming is the way that they come across to me.
Right, and that makes them kind of entirely seemingly intelligent mm-hmm. and very approachable. You know, I feel like, you know, although of course I'd be like starstruck and stuff like that if I had ever seen them, like there's a bit of me that like, you know, it's like if I ever met Barton Fink, if he was a real character, how would I feel meeting him in real life? I'd be excited because I like his adventure and stuff like that, but at the same time, Barton is a character that is much like the Coens where I feel like... he's only excited about the craft. He's only wanting to show you his story. He is with fault as well. I don't want to make that comparison to the Coens because I don't personally know him, but a fault with his ability to listen and shut his mouth for a second and let someone like his friend next door, who we haven't been introduced yet, speak.
Mm-hmm.
I think that kind of character is an interesting protagonist because almost always I don't think you ever really get a protagonist like this. Like,
No.
He's a stranger in a strange place, but that's kind of the twist on the twist is really the type of character he is and not so much what happens to him.
Yeah. It's a really odd film because we have, it's probably the first two thirds is this kind of character study and it's a stranger in a strange land kind of a thing. And he's, you know, this cipher for the audience and he's, you're like, oh man, look how weird Hollywood is. You know, all he's trying to do is make this movie and he's having a tough time and come on, Barton, just start writing. You know, that's kind of the way that you're feeling, or at least the way that I was feeling, while I'm just kind of, and I'm kind of passively watching it. Like, I'm not actively watching. You know, I'm just sitting back, and I'm like, oh, man, okay, well, I hope he figures it out, whatever. And we have the introduction of John Goodman, who plays Charlie Meadows. And John Goodman, it is most John Goodman. Just very imposing physically and very booming voice and big personality. And with the little hat tip or the little head tick that he kind of does. With the little hand expression as he leaves the rooms. Just these little things that I'm like, he's all right. Charlie Meadows, he's an all right guy.
A heartwarming guy.
Oh, yeah.
Real lovable.
Yeah, know, just completely setting you up, right? And so I'm like, okay, I like this. We meet Audrey Taylor and W.P. Mayhew, played by John Mahoney, and she was played by Judy Davis. And W.P. Mayhew is this, you know, famous author that Barton Fink is kind of starstruck by, and he's a little dismayed when he finds out that Audrey has maybe had a hand in writing some of his work. And that's an interesting section there. And I also found it interesting that W.P. Mayhew was based on a real person. He was based on the author William Faulkner.
Yeah, that's another reason why Zach should have been on the show tonight, too, because he is a huge Faulkner fan. And you're right. Like, he's based on that real guy of, like, just this... if anyone knows William Faulkner, it's one of those things that you can easily make that comparison.
Yeah.
Even before Fink finds out that he is, not even completely the writer, if at all the writer of his mm-hmm. actual works.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, he finds out that he is a terrible drunk. Meeting him the first time, even finding out like all this stuff, and then also at the same time, finding out that he's very abusive to the person that
To his mistress, Audrey Taylor, right?
Yeah, and the person who ultimately helps him all the time.
Mm-hmm. You know, so. And that is the sort of quintessential Coen Brothers moment for me up until this point is when he meets WP the first time. And John Mahoney's character is in the bathroom just throwing up like nobody's business. And he gets out and they just kind of look at each other. And it's this very kind of awkward movie moment. And he says like, oh, sorry about the odor or something like that. And then he just kind of leaves. And it's just this real like quiet sort of moment that just... has, I don't know if it's the tone or what it is exactly, but if I were to see that out of context, I would think, oh, that's from some Coen Brothers movie. It just seems like that sort of thing, right?
Yeah,
it just has a little level of absurdity to it.
Totally.
That really strikes me as that. So we have kind of the introduction of most of the characters. Tony Shalhoub is also, plays another fast-talking agent who is very entertaining in a much different role than I'm used to seeing him in. I'm used to seeing him in as kind of the John Turturro type role, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
This
was
Woody,
good though.
Yeah. The almost Woody Allen type, like real nebbish kind of like, oh geez, sort of.
That's a very good point. He's very, Woody Allen-ish too.
Yeah.
It's like a little splash of that in there.
Yeah. So we have all those guys in play and we do have, brief sequences with Steve Buscemi also playing Chet.
Who I think his purpose was to kind of show that first shot of him. They don't show the plane landing. They don't show him traveling at all. The next shot is right after that water crashes against that rock.
Mm-hmm.
It just fades slowly into the opening. Like it's kind of like a lowering crane shot of the interior of the hotel lobby.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a division from the restaurant or whatever the heck they were before, because it's so 40s Californian, you know, otherworldly.
Right.
And for Chet to suddenly come up out of nowhere, literally out of a trap door, and hand him a little card that says, "My name's Chet," and he hands him, you know, the little thing that says Chet on it. You know.
Yeah, with an exclamation point. Yeah.
It's although that character, I think that character's purpose was to serve just to show how otherworldly it's him meeting the Munchkins for the first time after stepping out of the house from the tornado. He's really just, you know, he's the introduction to this strange world that he's in.
Yeah. We can get into what the hotel is, in a little bit and why Chet's entrance is, of import. But just kind of going along with the sort of standard plot of it all. So Totoro has, you know, problems writing. He enlists, he wants WP Mayhew to help him. And then he finds out he's drunk. Audrey Taylor comes to help eventually. And they sleep together, right? That's the assumption.
Yes.
And Fink wakes up and notices a mosquito on her. And he kind of notices it for a while and gives it a good whack. And I'm like, well, that's a bad move. You know, like, you don't wake her up, first of all. That's a bad move. And then there's this really large blood splatter from the mosquito. And I'm like, wow, that's odd. Like, that's an odd choice. And then we find out that Audrey Taylor has been killed. And
this was my Coen Brothers moment, because this takes a turn.
And I'm Barton Fink's now in this hotel room with a dead woman, and she is dead, like capital D dead, like the blood all over, and it looks like she's in, you know, really been, you know, been injured in quite a severe way. I was trying to say that the nicest way I could.
Yeah.
And so I put, you know, wow, crazy dramatic turn. What the heck? So I was just like, this really came out of nowhere, because like I said, I was very much into this thinking that this was going to be just a character study and just kind of this quiet little movie and you know, and it all of a sudden is slapping you upside the head and is like, look at this shit. You're like, whoa, what is going on? What is happening? So what is it that made you think Coen Brothers about that sequence?
I mean, like, there's so many moments in this film that remind me of the other. It's hard to classify the Coen Brothers films because they're all so different from each other in genre and in style. But there are a few ticks that each one does that I see echoes in other movies. So a moment like waking up and seeing this person dead sounds like something that would happen in, like Blood Simple or Big Lebowski.
Mm-hmm.
But a moment like what, when you go in and you have all these like larger than life characters, like Lipsick, and he's just going crazy or whatever. I'm echoes of Lebowski and another, they're funny. You know, a serious man.
Serious man, yeah.
It's like there's the rabbi in that one, and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Like there's all these strange people and instances, and anything can happen at any moment, and that's why I'm particularly oh gosh, I was just about to spoil Inside Llewyn Davis. I was about to spoil something that happens in it, but there's another death in that movie that's completely out of nowhere. And you're just like, wait, what? you're not given a chance to slow down, or there's no foreshadowing. And it's very effective because you're right there with Fink. You're right there with the character, you know, in the other film. Like, you're piecing what the hell just happened in your head. So you feel that rush of panic and, gosh, what am I going to do? And luckily, Charlie, his next door neighbor, hears this extremely girly scream of Barton Fink and comes running right into the room.
Mm-hmm.
I think. No, he knocks on the door.
He comes, he definitely comes in. No, Charlie, Barton's screaming and Charlie comes in because he wants to know what's going on, right?
No, well,
isn't that right?
He doesn't come in until Barton shows him.
He goes,
Charlie, you gotta know I didn't do this. I didn't do this. And he goes, what, man, what? And he goes in and he goes, oh, shit. Like, he goes and throws up.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right. Okay, right. Yes. So that's interesting. And then, you know, from this point to the end of the film, I was just writing questions. Questions after questions after questions. Just saying, what does this mean? What's the symbolism here? What does this mean? Does this mean this? Does this mean that? And so I will spare the audience me just asking and just grilling Ben, expecting him to be the
oh boy,
yeah, to be the one to have the burden of answering these questions for me. But I did have a question earlier in the film, and this is when I believe Charlie has just left, and I didn't pick up on it at the time, but it is definitely a thing that only happens when Charlie's there or when Charlie has just left, and it's the wallpaper.
Oh.
So the wallpaper starts peeling, right? It has this sort of, it's as this like glue-like substance that keeps dripping out of it.
Yeah.
Or seeping out of it. It's also at the end, which we haven't yet spoiled, but we will. It's the same sort of substance that seeps out of Charlie.
Yes.
Out of his ear due to his ear infection.
This movie is full of echoes.
Uh-huh.
It's something that calls back to something else. And I see it and I think about the thing that I saw. Also, he pushes his ear up to the wall when he hears someone next door.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like it's a couple having sex.
Right.
But who the heck knows, because we're never shown that. We can only just turn up the volume so high on your television before your wife tells you to stop. But he pushes.
I want to hear this shit.
Yeah, I want to know what's going on. I turn on subtitles so I can hear what are they saying? You know,
indistinct like, moaning, probably.
Yeah, or something like that. Yeah, that's actually good. Yeah. And he pushes his ear up to the wall to hear it, but he turns it away, and it's almost like his ear's kind of sticky or something like that too. Yeah, and then you see it flow out of his ear at the end. Of Charlie, who's at that point. Well, we'll spoil that here in a minute.
Sure.
But yeah, I never caught the fact that it's always after Charlie leaves, or when he's there or something like that. It's always a moment when
he's always surrounding him. He's always involved, and I think in almost, if not every, but I think in almost every scene that Charlie is involved in, John Goodman is commenting how it's hot. It's so hot. Right, and that's what part of the problem is for him, is that it's so hot all the time. And so before we get to that end, I kept thinking, okay, so the wallpaper, it's peeling for a reason, right? The Coen brothers don't have it in there just for nothing. Is it his sanity? And the wallpaper's representing his sanity? And it's peeling like he's sort of losing his mind? Or what is it? Like, what is this? Is this like a freaking... I thought for a minute it was like a sort of like a Being John Malkovich sort of a thing.
Sure.
Where it's like, are we in just Barton Fink's mind? Like, is none of this actually happening, or what's going on?
I can see that.
Right?
I don't think it's going to be a clear answer either.
Oh,
like,
no.
And I'm sure you know that, but at the same time, like, what those moments, you and I both kind of pretty much had that same reaction to those moments of like the seeping. Or the dilapidation of the mind or something like that. Uh-huh. This is Fink's room. It's his place that he goes to work. It's his place that he sees. It's his, you know, it's his constructed safe mind place or whatever. And you see it dilapidating a little bit every time someone gets involved.
And right.
Someone is Charlie.
Yes, and what's also, what goes along with that for me as well is that we have Chet, going back to him, is I felt like, okay, this whole thing is, for a while, I thought this whole thing is in Barton Fink's mind, and Chet is conveniently like coming up from the depths, and so I thought it was like a hell representation. And so he was like coming up from the underworld. John Goodman's always talking about how it's hot, you know, this, that, and the other. And so I was like, okay, well, this is all like a representation of his inner hell or his sort of mental hell or what have you. And then we have the end with all of the fire. And I was like, okay, this character is the devil then, you know, and I was just like trying to like piece it together, and it doesn't quite work. For me, like, I was not satisfied with that. I was like,
there's
okay.
So many pieces.
And
there's
like,
so many pieces. Why is he an insurance salesman? Why is he trying to sell a little peace of mind? You know, I'm just trying to sell this insurance here and trying to be nice to you. And like, he's just so, like, he's so adamant that people get this.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Is that they won't be able to survive without buying insurance from him.
Yeah.
You know, and but also it's a good way to show that he's a working stiff. He's a guy that's just a, you know, blue collar, goes in and goes door to door and sells you insurance, but is real nice. You know, he gives that impression away.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also this bit of like, he comes over immediately after being called by Chet.
Yes.
And knocks on the door. And I think he's going to get the shit kicked out of him, Martin, that is.
Uh-huh.
And he ends up having a drink with him.
Yeah, and Charlie, like that's the great thing about John Goodman is he can play cuddly, lovable, common man, and then he can play like a scary guy at the turn
of
the hat.
Yeah, oh, totally. Right? Yeah, there's this intimidation of like a look, just a real quick look of who Charlie truly is, and we find out his name or later, but then it all kind of like goes away, and a smile goes across his face, and he reaches over to his flask and starts unscrewing the cap and says, well, at least they bottle it, and starts to pour himself and him a drink, and like you just fall in love with him again because he's so dang charming.
Yeah. Well, he is. Okay, so and getting to let's get to the end. Let's get to the reveal, which
yeah.
We pretty much kind of danced around it quite a bit. So we have Charlie, who's this traveling salesman, and we have these two officers who show up and say that John Goodman's character's name is not Charlie, his last name is Munt, and that he's going around and killing these people and taking their heads, and Barton has this box. And it's very Seven, like, you know, it's like, what's in the box? It's that sort of thing.
Exactly, yeah. They don't show you, do they?
No, they don't show you.
Man, is that infuriating. But at the same time, I kind of love it, but they don't.
And so
you feel like you know what you're going to see in there.
Yeah, oh, you definitely expect it, for sure, yeah. Especially watching it now, you know, years after I saw Seven. It's like, oh, okay, well, this is definitely somebody's head, right? Like, I'm expecting it. And so I'm getting to this where I was struggling with the wallpaper and the hell and all of that. I was like, okay, so Munt's the devil and Goodman and the fire in the hotel hallway that represents hell. And is it that John Turturro's kind of become friends with him? So he's, you know, like working with the devil, or it's the devil inside of him? Like, because the officers at one point, are talking to Turturro, to Barton Fink, and questioning him. Like, he's the one who's done it. Like, he's the one who's killed these people, right? And so I'm like, okay, well, does Munt or Charlie Meadows, does he not actually exist? And is Barton just losing his mind? You know, and I'm, like, going through all of these, like, possible scenarios, and the movie doesn't give you any of them. Right? It doesn't tell you, here's what it is. It doesn't say, hey, Ben, here's exactly, everything was real. We're not going to explain the fire so much, but everything pretty much happened. And here's the painting at the end of the movie, and have a nice day. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of what they do. And
yeah, very ambiguous.
Yeah, and that's like,
Open to interpretation.
Yeah, I really like that. And at the same time, it's a thing that makes me struggle with it a little
maddening.
Bit. Yeah, and it's a thing where I feel like I want that, and then I get it, and I'm kind of not upset by it, but I'm like, oh, come on. And it's me not being able to have my own conclusion, maybe, is what frustrates me. Because I want to make sure, like, I don't want to just conclude, oh, well, he's an angel, and John Goodman's a devil, and, you know, I don't want to have something that I just make up. I want it to be right, and I want it to have proof. And so when there's none, when it's up to interpretation, or when it's, you know, interpretive at least, it makes me do a little work, and I don't mind doing the work. I just want to be right when I do the work. You know what I mean? Like, I just want to be, I want to have the correct interpretation, which is kind of an oxymoron, right? The correct interpretation.
Yeah. So. I you said it. I mean, I come out of there, I feel so frustrated, and my compulsion to want answers is so strong. And then after sitting there and thinking about it and just listening to the echoes throughout the film,
mm-hmm.
and like what means what and where things go and like how all these pieces are so evenly constructed and just come in at the right times, like a symphony almost. It plays so well that because I'm sitting there, and to bring it all back to the front of the yes. TV, I guess, when we were talking about how I'm completely absorbed. All right, I'm giving this my full attention. Phones are off. Nothing else matters. What's going on in this world? I sit down and I'm absorbed. I am making connections, much like people in this movie should be doing, you know, webbing it all together and feeling like, what does this mean? And at some points it doesn't mean anything. It's just supposed to construct some feelings and stuff. But when you get to that ending, yeah, I almost feel like not showing what's in the box. Why all of a sudden is he there on the beach? Does that even matter? I mean, is that a representation of him back at the desk? I mean, what could mm-hmm. it possibly mean? Mm-hmm. I just went with it.
I
don't think it's, I know I've only seen it twice and stuff like that, but like, I don't consider this my favorite one almost because of that. Mm. One of my favorite Coen Brothers films because of what's going on there. But at the same time, I love it because of that. You know, even in a similar way that I'm about to spoil No Country for Old Men, so sorry, everybody. even with the protagonist of that film, what eventually ends up happening to him mm-hmm. and whatever what ends up happening to Anton Chigurh isn't completely satisfying in a way. I mean, well, essentially,
especially the way that the film ends with the wiping of his shoes and then the speech with Tommy Lee Jones.
I would even say after the wiping of his shoes, when he gets in that car accident, he's got a bone sticking out of his arm.
Right.
Much like the bringer of death, but human still. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He scurries away like a rat. He runs off and stuff like that. Like, things just kind of never get resolved. And much in the way of real life, sometimes things don't get resolved too much.
Sure, yeah.
So then, you know, I that's kind of why I'm like, well, I really invested in this movie. I really wanted to see it all kind of play out and stuff like that. Well, of course it's not going to play out, because it's trying to mimic that motion of life and how there sometimes these loose ends don't get brought up. But what's interesting is it somehow seems all interconnected in some way. At least that's how mm-hmm. I view life in some way. You know, there's connections I'm constantly making to other things that don't even seem relatable at all. Mm-hmm. Yet here I am like going, oh, I think that makes sense. Or, oh, it's here that this goes or something, you know. All of it is just, to me, the ending of that film, I don't know if it could work any other way.
Oh,
I don't even know any other film that can do something like this and get away with it.
Yeah, that's the thing where, you know, I think about how I'm like, God, I'm kind of frustrated with the way that ended. And I don't know that I get it. You know, I have those kind of broad, like, self-doubt questions. Like, God, did I understand what was going on there? I don't know that I did.
And that feeling I said about how, oh, you know, it's not my favorite Coen Brothers, blah, blah, blah. Now, after having dealt with this and talking with you about it and thinking about it over time, it might be one of the best Coen Brothers films.
Well, that's the way that it always happens, isn't it, Ben? It's like, yeah. I don't know if I really liked Eyes Wide Shut, and then at the end I'm like, oh my God, I fucking love
this
that
movie. This might be really good. Yeah. You
know? That's good. I mean, that's what happens when you allow yourself, you know, an hour to sit and kind of
you unpack
talk
it.
About it with somebody else. Yeah. And that's the point. Yeah. Yeah, I mean
that's why we do this show, man.
That's right. That's why the show exists, right there.
So we can ponder the bigger questions in life, while our wives look at us and shake their heads in shame.
Definitely. You know, Anel didn't watch this one with me. She would have not been on board with it.
She wouldn't have done it.
She would have struggled. Yeah.
Oh.
So what I think is interesting is this just popped into my head while you were speaking there at the end, and it reminds me of something that I remember from my undergraduate days at University of Nebraska Lincoln, and I was at the Sheldon, which is the university and the town's art gallery, and I was there, and they had a comic book feature, and so the entire art gallery was all different comic book stuff, and so it ran the gamut from strips to Alex Ross, right? So it's everywhere and in between. And we went to this the speech, and it was guys like Bill Sienkiewicz, and I think like Howard Porter was there because he was a bigger name at the time. And this is the late 90s. And so I get there, and Sienkiewicz talks about how if you go to a regular art museum and you don't understand a piece of art, the educated person will think, well, I just don't get it. I just don't understand it. It's on me. Like, it's a great piece of art. I just don't understand what it's saying. But then when you see something that you feel like is beneath you or below you, like how some people view comic art or strips, and you don't understand it, it's because the work is not effective, right? The work didn't do enough to speak to me. And what I'm getting at is when I see a film written and directed by the Coen brothers, and I see the name Coen on the screen, and I don't quite get the end or what they're going for, I put that on myself. I feel like I didn't understand. It's clearly there. I just didn't pick the right interpretation that I've ran with, and now I can't get my head out of that. To where if I saw this same movie and it had the name Michael Bay or McG or somebody else that I don't think of as a esteemed director.
Wow.
If I saw that, I'd be like, that movie sucks. Look at this. Like, what kind of an ending is that? That's a cop-out ending, right? And so it's just funny to me watching a film based on who created it and their sort of their cachet with me. That I'm like, oh, okay, well, this is a Coen Brothers thing, so I need to dig deeper. I need to think about this more, as opposed to just shoving it aside, saying, ah, oh, that didn't work. That didn't work for me, and just forget about it. You know? So I just think that that's really interesting how, depending on the people behind the film, it sort of influences the way I think about the movie, regardless of what's on screen.
Yeah, I guess you're right. You have a certain expectation going into one of these films, mm-hmm. and I've been hit so many times with that surprise or where these films go and how they end up and stuff like that. And a lot of the times they may seem unsatisfying because we're so conditioned to get satisfying conclusions in our Spielberg world or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we end up just expecting that too much or something, and it just doesn't happen. But either way, like, there's got to be a reason why, because my first thought was, oh my gosh, like, I feel like I need more answers. I don't want to go on without it here and leave it right here on the beach with the picture of the lady and stuff.
Right,
like,
right.
What else could there possibly be and stuff like that? And yet, it's still at the same time, as I'm sitting in my car, putting my seatbelt on to drive home, I'm ordering the Blu-ray on off of Amazon to mm-hmm. be sent to my house.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, you know, I must have really liked it because I enjoyed my experience. But at the same time, I'm being fed this thing that I'm like, wait a minute. Like, I feel a little unsatisfied.
Sure.
But at the same time, that might be the sizzle to the steak that we're talking about. That might be.
That's the thing, right?
Maybe for me, that is good enough.
Not good enough
like I'm being apologetic to it. Good enough as in, like, this made me feel something.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
It made me feel a want that I didn't get, and that's kind of the point.
Yeah, I think so, and I do like the fact that I didn't really know what to take away from it. And, you know, because we had this very meta commentary, I felt like, with the Coen brothers and it being Barton Fink. And then it just kind of went and changed in this completely different film. And I was like, God, was that intentional? Was that something that they decided to rewrite? Was that, you know, is that the way, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, is that the way they should have done it? You know, and putting on this pretense like I know how they should have done it. And this wasn't the way, or, you know, I'm having those sort of thoughts. And I come away at the end thinking, well, goddamn, at least the movie's making me think. like, at least it's making me ask all of these questions as to what it is, as to, you know, what it was going for, as to what was real and what wasn't, what was meta, what wasn't, what the ending means. There's plenty of other movies that I don't fully grasp, and it's because I don't think they were very well made. And that's not this for me. You know?
It's amazing, though, that we feel like we can tell the difference.
Yeah, and that's what's so hard about it, is I'm not able to put my finger on why it's different, but it is different. And it's not like it's, you know, Roger Deakins is a great cinematographer. It's not like it's because of some shot that I remember the film for. And, you know, Totoro and Goodman and all of the other players in the film, they've been in several other movies that I've, you know, not enjoyed and not thought as long about as this film.
Another good example would be something like Nymphomaniac, which I watched both parts 1 and 2 late last year, towards the end of the year, mostly because I heard, you know, critics talk about it, or
Lars von Trier is an interesting guy.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy, and the movie's very interesting and stuff like that. And no matter what, there are connections. So, you know, but why am I so drawn to the connections that the Coen brothers make and not in their films, and like almost like a connective cinematic poem that I'm interested in watching, and yet not falling for the Lars von Trier version of some of his stuff? I'm not saying I didn't like the film, but I'm saying I didn't have as strong of opinion as I did to Barton Fink, with the way that they decide to use their visual and storytelling poetry to echo and make those do pretty much the Coen brother tricks that they do.
Sure. You know, I don't think that it's a thing where you could look at a script and say, oh, here it is. Here's what they do.
That's a good point. Yeah.
You know, it's just something in the way that the magic is made between the two of them, between them writing and directing their own material. And so that's why it is a little interesting to see what's going to happen when the two of them write a film that's directed by Steven Spielberg. You're like, wow, that's going to be weird. We'll see what that's going to be like.
That's a very good point.
It's going to be an interesting mix. You know, I mean, it was a thing where in a much different conversation when I was talking to my friend Mr. Sean Stangland, and we were talking about the movie Tomorrowland, and I had said we got off on a tangent about the Wachowskis, and about how they were fledgling, and you know, we were anticipating Sense8 that is now on Netflix, and I had said that I wished that the Wachowskis would just have someone that was good at writing, or someone that was intriguing and wrote intriguing stories, would write something for them. And I was like, well, what if Damon Lindelof, the writer of Prometheus and Lost and Tomorrowland, would write something for the Wachowskis? What would that be like? And so we went on a thing where it's like, holy shit. First of all, who would fund it? Because Lindelof has not had great success, and neither has the Wachowskis. And what would that be? And that's kind of what I think of in a definitely more artistic Oscar bait style of the Coen brothers mashed with Steven Spielberg. It's like, what is that going to be? You know, how are those styles going to translate with each other?
Yeah, just because they're two tastes that you love doesn't mean that they're going to taste great together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting part is Matt Charman, or Charman, I guess it should be. He is another writer on the film, Bridge of Spies.
Okay.
And I don't know his work at all. He's written Sweet, Francaise, and Patriot's Day, which are a couple of screenplays. And that's kind of it before this movie with the Coens and Steven Spielberg. So I don't know how he landed that deal, but that's quite the heavy hitters that you're working with on your first major film. So we'll see how that goes. That is supposed to come out a few months after this releases. That's supposed to come out in October.
Oh, nice.
Three, 4 months after this comes out. So
there we go.
Okay. Well, Barton Fink, Ben, any last thoughts on Barton Fink?
I don't think so. I think we covered everything in my notes at least. And I'm sure once we hang up, I'll be like, oh no, I wanted to talk about that or this. But I just think my recommendation, if you heard the beginning of this episode, you already know my recommendation for this. I definitely think you should find the time, find the energy to to immerse yourself in it. I ended up feeling very rewarded at the end. Maybe not at first, but feeling very rewarded for having paid so much attention and had gotten so much out of this film, that, you know, my recommendation is to read it. Oh my goodness. Watch it in complete immersion, because it's kind of how I saw it.
Mm.
So, I mean, the first time at least.
Yeah, I will say I'm definitely very envious of you seeing this on the big screen in the manner that you did. I know that there's only two films that I've seen like that, and I think I had a very, very strong reaction to one, and watching it again at home was like, ooh, do I like this? Do I like this?
Not even sure, yeah. You know?
It was the movie I'm talking about was 300. I saw that in the theater front row and was like, holy shit. Like, oh, this is awesome. And watched it at home and went, all right.
Different reaction.
All right, yeah. Like, well, this doesn't look as cool on the 40 inch, you know.
That's a very good point.
The other one was Lord of the Rings: Two Towers, and I had the same experience at home and at the theater. I liked them quite a bit both times. So
awesome.
So there you go. Okay, so yeah, I think my thoughts are pretty well already said. So wrapping us up, if you have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about specifically for Podshots, you could email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. And we did get a couple of emails that our next episode of Podshots is actually going to be a listener recommendation. You could follow the show over at Twitter as well. Our handle is @plainlabelpod, where you could follow me. I'm @ericwilliams79. We also have a Facebook page for the show where you could like it. Just search for Plain Label Podcast. And say you wanted to help us out a little bit, us meaning Rachel and me, you could head over, not Ben, because, I mean, Ben doesn't need any help. Look how good Ben's doing. He doesn't need any help. You could head over to Amazon.com, and you could search for our wish list. It's full of the movies that we want, equipment that we need, and a whole host of other goodies if you're in the giving mood. Just search for the wish list called Plain Label Podcast. So I do want to thank Mr. Teed.
Yeah.
Mr. Ben Teed for coming on and discussing Barton Fink and getting into a new director. If they wanted to hear more from you or get in touch with you, where could they do so?
The best place right now, because my phone is always on me and I always get notifications, is Twitter.
Is the Twitters. And your handle?
@BenTeed, BenTiede.
There you go.
You'll see all the pictures of me at my new job.
All of them. That's good. With the new house?
New house, new job, new wife.
Man.
Same as the old wife.
He's got it going on, that team.
Only one wife.
This guy. He's got all of the families that he's babysitting for as well. And the dog. And the dog in the background occasionally.
Yeah.
Watching out for that guy, too. It's no problem. Okay, so thank you for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.